Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian Seawood. Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. This afternoon, we come to you to talk about the latest film from Quentin Tarantino. Tarantino's ninth feature film, depending on how you want to count. Once Upon a Time, in Hollywood. With me today is our good friend,
Stephen Beecham, good friend of Brian's and oftentimes his movie buddy when Chad can't make it.
Yes, a family friend and a very intelligent and articulate individual when it comes to movies and his passion for them.
So well, this build should, it up, why don't you?
So this should be a good time. So what is it about Tarantino? Like, why his films?
You know, I'm not sure I can really answer that other than I just love them. I know that's a generic, boring answer, but some people say they all feel the same. They all feel so different to me. I love the characters, the different characters. I love the blood. I just love that part. There's a section of this movie where I heard you howling in laughter. My favorite part as well.
Yeah. We'll get to that. I just, you know, for me it's his dialogue. We're increasingly getting to a point in time in cinema culture where there's four writers on every movie, and where the distinctive voices are kind of trapped behind the camera in that they're just directors. They're not writers and directors. It's kind of like that old, it's kind of like the way that the singer-songwriter is kind of phased out of popularity over the last 20 years or so.
Tell me about it.
So, you know, the days of writers and directors are starting to fade. And while there are unique voices like Nolan, for example, Nolan doesn't write. But he uses his artistic art form as his direction. So his camera movements, his angles, like, you know, the way those are the way that he tells his story differently from subject to subject. Mm-hmm. Whereas someone like Tarantino has that Tarantino dialogue, and it's a very specific rhythm, and it's a very specific characterization of characterization, and that's what I, you know, why I love Tarantino as a filmmaker, is because we don't have a lot of those inspired voices running around cinema anymore.
I agree completely with that. I can't believe I didn't think of it. Pulp Fiction is the first one that grabbed me with that dialogue like that. And then I sort of... Did you feel it as much in this movie? I didn't feel like the dialogue was quite as snappy as it normally is. I loved the movie. Spoiler alert there. I loved it. But I didn't feel like he was quite on point with that. There were other things happening.
I think this is his most... Probably since Pulp Fiction, his most buddy movie. And so there are more, like, you don't have as many monologues. Like, I can probably pick you out the two biggest monologues that he has in the movie. One is the Bruce Lee monologue about Cassius Clay. And the other one would be DiCaprio's meltdown after he botches the line where he just basically threatens to blow his own brains out. Like, those are the two, like, specific monologue scenes. Everything else is kind of back and forth conversation.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a different deal than something like, say, Django or Hateful Eight, where it was two or three or four people bouncing off one another, mm-hmm. where his dialogue does just snap and work. So I think that might have been the thing, was that there were more one-on-one conversations and less, like, massive group scenes and more monologues than normal.
Yeah, that's something I noticed during the movie. I remember thinking about midway through, man, it doesn't sound like a Tarantino movie. This is a little different than what I'm used to.
This is his most accessible film for a general audience. This is his sweetest film, if you want to put that connotation mm-hmm. on it. This is his ode to 1969 Hollywood, in a place that has a fond memory for him and growing up in the area and the impacts all of that had. And, you know, he was 8 in 69. And okay. So, you know, it's just very much that childhood imagery of things. So, like, the way that we think and view the world and the things around us at 8 is different from the way that we experience them when we're 28. Mm-hmm. Like, he's holding up in Revenants this thing that makes him feel, that takes him back to his youth and takes him back to that wide-eyed innocence and wonder, which is something you don't get a lot in Tarantino movies. Most of the time in Tarantino movies, you get jaded, rugged, that kind of a thing.
Yeah, I definitely felt that wistfulness of the past, that he had that going on for sure. You could tell he loved it.
Yeah.
Just the scenery that he put together and the immersion.
His production designer was...
It was unreal.
On point.
What really impressed me, the street scenes. All the extras in the period clothes, I mean, everybody can handle that for the most part, but the cars, the shops they did a good job with, just the entire feel was there. It felt like the 60s for sure. He knocked that out of the park. And not everybody can do that. I mean, everybody can get the dress up, but...
It takes having a great relationship with your production designer, and it takes your production designer working their rear end off to make that happen. Because, yeah, sure, you can go in and digitally matte paint anything, right? But, like, to do it with minimal matte painting and just, like, literally transform things is, is just a brilliant thing to do. And, again, it just comes back to my mind of that there are not a lot of directors in Hollywood who have the ability to tell a major studio, I'm going to write this, I'm going to direct this, we're going to do it this way, and... we'll see you at the premiere.
Mm-hmm. What do you think they did digitally? I didn't catch it. They shut down, obviously, several streets. Must have been for at least an entire day to get these shots. And then there were some interstate shots.
There were
some freeway shots.
Freeway shots. And then some of the surface streets can be backlot. And you can, obviously construct your own backlot set. But, I mean... the one map thing that I would go to is the Fox lot. Yeah, the overhead shot of the, when she gets out of the car, to the sky crane shot when she's getting out of the car hugging the woman that she's, the hitchhiker she's picked up.
Yeah.
And then, like, the overhead shot of that kind of felt matted. But everything else, I'll point specifically to a scene in the movie that is between the landing of the plane when we catch up with these characters again in August of 69, the landing of the plane with Cliff and Rick on it, to them getting at the Rick and Cliff going to the bar. It is just a series of shots of illuminating signs. It's all that transition from night to day and the neon signs and just all the signs are period accurate. They're all important places. The only other thing that I would point to as far as like digital, the drive-in. The drive-in was all digital because you can't find drive-ins to shoot in anymore. So,
I suppose so.
Yeah. So, I mean, they did a fantastic job on that, and like, to even down to the period Taco Bell.
That was cool.
Yeah.
I was born in 77, so I was not around for any of this or old enough to remember anything,
right?
Any old shows, trying to feel like it earlier in my life. But I remember thinking when they were going to all those restaurants that he had done such a good job with the rest of the movie. I was like, I bet you that's exactly what that restaurant looked like in 68 when all these people were eating there, and it was these famous restaurants. I'm sure people from that time period in California will watch the movie and say that's exactly what it felt like to go eat at those two Mexican restaurants at that period of time.
And even just the difference between the feels of the two Mexican restaurants, the upper scale,
the upscale
Mexican restaurant that Sharon and her and her friends are at versus the low rent one that Rick and Cliff are at.
Tied one on in. Yeah. Love that scene too.
So, I mean, I feel like this will be easily his most accessible film. I think that it'll find an audience, hopefully. My concern for this film is it's a hangout movie that revolves around two guys for 2 hours and 50 minutes. There's exactly 10 minutes of bloodshed in the entire thing, which, as you know, is not a Tarantino... Like, blood is a Tarantino staple.
Yeah.
So, like, to only get 10 minutes of it is going to be a hindrance for accessing it, for it to be accessible to younger people.
Agreed. Boy, was it satisfying.
Right. It was satisfying because you built up to it for...
Yeah. Oh, you did? Yeah, you did.
But the end is, like... This movie hinges on a knowledge, at least a baseline knowledge of who Charles Manson is, who the Manson family is, and what happened on August 9th, 1969 in the Hollywood Hills. Because if you don't know, then that establishing shot of the street sign in the first 15 minutes of the movie, telling you, I think it's Cleo Court or whatever it is, that doesn't register with you if you don't know anything about that. The ending to this film doesn't resonate with you if you don't know that. The scenes at the ranch don't resonate with you if you don't know who these creepy women are with hairy armpits. The concern for me is that anybody under 30 is not going to have that knowledge, and as soon as the movie's over, they're going to be Googling their heads off trying to figure out, you know, what a spaghetti western was.
I couldn't help it. I loved the movie. I ran home and got online and started reading some reviews. And I was disappointed to see all the comments about it dragging at first, because I didn't feel that. Yes, it was a little slower than the rest of the movie, than the end of the movie, clearly. But I was into it. I liked the character development, and I think you're right. I think it's because I knew, or I expected to know, what was coming at the end. And I was invested in watching Sharon Tate and her just running errands, whatever she was doing. I was just waiting to find a detail that was, oh, yep, I remember that being part of the Manson story. And if you don't have that, I bet you do get bored. And I, you know, at first I was upset. Everybody was saying it was so boring. I was like, I can't believe you thought this movie was boring. You're onto something with that if they don't know at least a tiny portion of the story and what happens in the end to this delightful Sharon Tate.
Because every
Margot Robbie kills.
Because everything is a subversion of that.
Yeah.
Every time you think you know where he's going with the story, the best example of that I can give is the scene where Manson starts walking. He's just walking.
Mm-hmm.
And Jay sees him and Jay confronts him. And you're like in your head, because you have that prior knowledge, you're thinking of, okay, well, he's casing the scene.
Yeah.
Right? He's casing the house. He's trying to find entrance ways, trying to figure out how he can get his guys up here. And, you know, that scene has a tension to it because you have that knowledge. If you don't have that knowledge, it's just like, well, who's this guy?
Yeah, I was thinking to myself, I didn't know that this could be movie magic, or storytelling. Maybe Charles Manson did know the previous owners of that house and just walked up and didn't know that Roman Polanski lived there at the time. And I was thinking, I wonder how they're going to bring that back in. And surely he's going to tell the crew why he wants to go back to that house and get these specific, you know, Hollywood hotshots. He's going to, you know, they're going to have made him mad somehow. I expected a confrontation at the house more than we got, which we didn't get. And hopefully I'm not spoiling too much, but I expected a whole lot more of Charlie Manson. He pops in and you're like, okay, here we go. It's about to kick off. And that was it.
And the details there, even like, you don't get him at the ranch.
No.
So when he...
Yeah, because he's gone. Everybody, where's Charlie? Charlie?
They all went to San Jose.
Yeah.
Or Santa Monica. They all went to Santa Monica.
Yeah, maybe that's part of the lore too.
Yeah.
Or the history, I should say. Not the lore, but the history of Charles Manson. I don't know if
right,
that's part of the deal. I'm not that much of an expert.
Right, but that... It's, again, subverting the expectations. And that definitely is the case at the end, where you literally create an entire alternate history. But, like, if you don't... I don't feel like if you have that, even just a base cursory knowledge of it, that you're going to be able to enjoy the film as much. And also, again, it's a hangout movie. It's not like Django, where he's moving from set piece to set piece through these beautiful shots at these beautiful locations. And it's not even like Hateful Eight, while it's contained to the cabin, right? Those characters are so well drawn and so wacky and off the wall that you're okay. People forget Hateful Eight doesn't have bloodshed until the end of the second act. It takes a long time to get to the bloodshed in Hateful Eight. But once you do, he goes balls to the walls crazy with it. But it takes you a while.
Yeah, and that was a slow burn too. But the I think what made people hang on to that one more was the mystery.
Right.
There was a lot more mystery.
There was an actual plot there.
Yeah.
There isn't really a plot here. No. This is just a day in the life of Cliff Booth and Rick Dalton and Sharon Tate.
Yeah, and of course, like you said, with you know, Django and Inglourious Basterds, there's action every 10 damn minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, serious action. This one has very little of that.
And you're globetrotting, too. You're going from location to location. Mm-hmm. You're meeting new people all the time. This is not that. Like, yes, you have L.A. and it's a sprawling metropolis, and you do a lot in Brad Pitt's, you know, in Cliff Dalton's driving, mm-hmm. but like you don't get
his driving,
which was Pitt.
He was all over the road, that's for sure.
Well, so was Roman when Roman's coming down with Sharon when they're going to the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the era that's not too far removed from Dean, from James Dean,
mm-hmm.
who you know, of course, had his penchant for fat things that go really fast.
Yeah, unfortunately.
So, I mean, I think that the interesting part to me is that yes, it's a slow burn. Yes, it takes a while to get there. But you just enjoy these characters because they're so well written.
I loved them.
And if you don't invest in these characters, then none of the rest of the movie is going to pay off for you, and you are going to be sitting there bored. And also, it's expectations, too. Because if you walk in here expecting Django, and expecting to go from L.A. to San Jose to Santa Monica, you know, wherever, like, you know, then you're going to be disappointed. But...
Yeah, and I think a lot of the... Like you're saying, all the globe trotting, and a lot of the action in Django is advancing the plot, and making the story. The action, the early action, what little there is in this movie, is Hollywood action inside a Hollywood movie. It's
shootouts
on a TV stage where they're filming something, so it doesn't really feel like, you know, it's not real life. That's not really happening to these characters. There's not a lot of tension there. You're just watching a movie within a movie.
Right.
I can see how that wouldn't be as entertaining as, you know, Django is chasing these guys down and shooting them long range and
Django
bounties.
Look, there are exactly two shots in this movie that I can point to and say, I'd like that as a matte painting that I could put on my wall.
Okay.
Whereas with Django, every scene where they're on the horses, and especially that opening montage of just the mountains and the valleys and the wildlife and all of that, there's dozens of shots in there that I would frame and put on my wall.
Yeah, I think you got to be a lover of the 60s, and I think what you get, the scenery that you get from Tarantino, again, is the city. The city shots and the old school cars. I love the cars.
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't stop looking at him, trying to figure out which one was which.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was his painting shots,
right,
for that movie,
right? Especially the ones that I can think of, the two scenes driving down the hill. It's, you know, Cliff driving down the hill, going back to his apartment after his trailer, and Roman and Sharon going down the hill to the mansion.
Yeah, to the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah. So let's get into the thing that we loved, the thing that we liked, and the thing that we would change. So let's start with what we loved. Obviously, we've gushed a little bit about the film.
I can't help loving it. I love that one. I'm not saying it's one of my favorite. Well, I will say it's one of my favorite. It's not top two, but it's in the top five for certain.
This feels to me like his Oscar movie, And the thing that drives that to me the most is the fact that it is about Hollywood. And the Oscars and the Academy, at least the old Academy, loves movies about movies. I mean, we can point to something as recently as La La Land, which again is about old Hollywood and is a musical and is about the filmmaking process.
I guess you have a point there.
So,
you know, I was not sitting there thinking Oscar bait like you were. What sort of Oscar? I'm gonna steal something that I read from the reviews, but like in your mind, you're thinking like Best Picture.
Production design.
Yeah, that's gonna be. It's got to be in there.
Yeah, production design, costume design.
Yeah.
Best actor for Leo. Best director for Tarantino. Best original screenplay for Tarantino, and Best Picture.
Damn.
But you also have to remember that we're in almost August, so like the majority of the awards plays haven't come out yet.
It's gonna be heavy at the end.
It's back ended.
Mm-hmm.
But we have recent precedent, right? Grand Budapest Hotel was released in April. Mad Max Fury Road was released in May. Black Panther was released in February, almost a year out from the previous Oscar ceremony. So
There
we have now a recent history of, if you're a good film, it doesn't matter when you're released.
As it should be.
But traditionally, if you go by statistics, most Oscar winners are released in October or November.
They're timing it. I mean,
you have a season.
That's why I say Oscar bait.
Yeah.
That's why I didn't, I will freely admit to being a casual moviegoer. I'm sure the listeners are aware. I don't have, too much of an insight into this stuff, but I just didn't feel it from that movie. I could be completely wrong. I'm going to go a different direction and hopefully everyone won't laugh at me, but I love Brad Pitt in this movie. I thought Best Supporting Actor.
And that's the question, because he had Ad Astra coming out later in the year.
Oh, he's got his other movie. Yeah.
His space movie. That would seem to be the lead performance they'd want to put him in for. How strong will the Best Supporting field be? Would they submit him as a Best Supporting or a Best Actor? Like, that's... because him and Leo share the same amount of screen time almost second for second.
I didn't know that.
So, like, it's almost exactly even in terms of screen time. So, can you,
Well, this is... I'm saying that, and it feels impactful to me because I'm not really a Brad Pitt fan.
Mm-hmm.
I am just not a big fan of his acting. I don't think he's been too good in many of his movies. He feels like the same guy every time. He's playing a character, but it's Brad Pitt playing a character.
Right.
I loved him in this.
I did too.
He felt like a tryhard in Inglourious Basterds with
right.
that crazy accent, and maybe that was
the mustache.
Maybe he was supposed to be over the top. Clearly, he was a fanatic,
right?
Nazi killer. But it just seemed effortless to him in this one. I wasn't seeing Brad Pitt like I usually do.
Except for the scene on the rooftop.
Rooftop.
When the 50-year-old man takes his shirt off and still looks like he's 22.
Of course, he's still...
There's a few more tattoos. A few more tattoos, but he still looks like he's 22.
I remembered something when you said that I'd forgotten all the scars they put all over his character. Obviously, he was a beat-up stuntman. Yeah, he still looks 20.
Mm-hmm. So what was...
Maybe there are some people who agree with me that I know Brad Pitt is an A-list actor. I just... my side of the table or the movie seat, I don't see it in most of his movies. In fact, he takes me out of the movie too much and I do not enjoy a lot of his acting. Absolutely loved him in this one. Let's make a disclaimer for like Fight Club and 12 Monkeys, although he just had to act like a crazy person.
Right.
Maybe Seven, I don't know, but he still bothered me in Seven. The older movies I can deal with, the newer ones, it just feels like Brad Pitt to me.
Well, and the thing is, he's in that Leo territory, right? He's being far more selective about what he's taking. And he hasn't been doing a whole lot of the dramatic stuff. I mean, he's been doing stuff more akin to Burn After Reading. Like, he's been doing more of that over-the-top, funny comedy stuff. I mean, his big franchise tentpole the last 10 years was World War Z.
Yeah.
So I mean, he hasn't really been in that arena for a while. So like, he's been more selective about the roles that he takes and the impacts that they have. And I think this is probably his best dramatic work in quite some time.
I definitely think so.
Yeah. So was that the thing that you loved the most, or what was the thing that you loved the most?
Well, the thing that I love the most, this, you know, I guess because this is coming from a 42 and a half year old now, was, and I don't feel washed up or anything, but I'm watching Leo in his washed up Hollywood, you know, what's next for me? What am I going to do with my life? Am I burned out? Am I useless type deal? And he goes and he gets one of these bit parts as the heavy on somebody else's show. He's not even the star. And you know, Al Pacino's giving him that warning that they're hiring you to make their star look good. Mm-hmm. You know, they're using you to make the next up and comer. They're not in love with you. They're just using you. And he cracks on a couple of his lines in his first day on the set. Goes back to the trailer and has a tantrum and buckles down and comes back and nails it. That was my favorite part. I just wanted that for him so bad and loved it for the character too. I liked his acting in the acting within the acting.
Right.
I mean, it's
being
amazing
a bad
how
actor
good
is.
Is
hard.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about one of the best actors, but he how many different characters did he play in that show?
Right.
In Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I lost track. But that was I needed that for that movie, because I had him on the ropes, and I didn't think Tarantino was going to give it to him, and I was just unusually happy when he got it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I like there's a bunch there to unpack. So DiCaprio being at the stage in his career where he can go 5 years without acting, without doing a single movie.
Talking about real life. At this
real
point.
Life. Yeah. Real yeah. life being at a point where you don't have to work for 5 years, and then when you choose to come back to work.
You play a washed up actor.
Right. And the.
Yeah. Interesting part.
The other thing is, like, that scene is immediately preceded by his conversation with the young actress, the young child actor, which it. That scene in and of itself has a lot of resonance, considering that DiCaprio started as a child actor.
Yeah.
And she carries herself in a far more mature way.
Yeah, I didn't catch that. I didn't want to go yammering on too long, but I did like how they sort of started that story with her outclassing him, sitting there in the set chairs.
How
old
are you?
He's starting to realize, damn, this is... Should I be preparing like this? You can see, like, man, did I miss out? Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm not as good as that. You can just feel it. Mm-hmm. Starts crying and all that.
Yeah. Well, he's crying because he's reading the story about the Bronco Buster, which is the story of him.
Who's also washed up. Yeah.
So, that scene is one continuous take that breaks off when he flubs the line. Mm-hmm. And so, it's some of Tarantino's just best work as far as, like, framing the shot and the kind of angles that he's taking. And it... is shot like a 1960s TV Western.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they do the same thing with the black and white scene where he's talking to the other Tarantino, the guy that's always in Tarantino's films. Not Tim Roth, but the other one.
Oh, Michael Madsen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's talking to Madsen, and they cut, and then they go directly to the credits. Like, that is shot the same way you would shoot one of those 1960s yeah. TV Westerns. And that's an impressive feat, again, to me, for a director to be able to pull off.
Love those old Westerns. I noticed it immediately. Maybe that's why. Because he brought me back to those shows that I watch them all the time on Netflix and
mm-hmm.
Amazon Prime. I'm always watching these old Westerns. I watched them with my dad. I just love them.
Right.
And it was curious that I saw, you know, that caught me a little off guard when people were saying they didn't understand that we had switched gears and you weren't watching Leo...
In
Tarantino's movie, you were watching him acting on somebody else's set.
You're watching Rick Dalton acting in movie X.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as they switched gears, I just felt it. I just knew what we were watching. And then, you know, he flubs his line, and they rewind everything and reset and move the camera back.
And that's the part I love the most, that you actually see the movie, the camera move on the dolly all the way back around the table.
I definitely like that.
Yeah.
And then you can sort of feel everybody's disappointment. Like, oh God, we hired this guy Rick and he's screwing up first day. Here we go again. We should have got somebody else.
I didn't hire you to be Rick effing Dalton.
Yeah.
I hired you to be an actor, not a TV cowboy.
You know, it's all... Yeah, so you catch a lot of these things that I don't catch, but it started in the makeup room when they were turning him into somebody he wasn't. They're putting a goofy mustache and making him look like a hippie, and we'd already established in the movie, these fucking hippies, he hates these hippies. Like, they want him to look like a hippie. They're putting long hair on him and a mustache, and they don't want him to be himself.
They don't want to be recognizable.
Yep.
Which actually goes counterintuitive to the warning that Pacino gives him. So, like, I'm a pro wrestling fan, right? There is such a thing in pro wrestling as giving the rub to the next guy or putting someone over, especially when you get to the later stages of your career.
Yeah, that's a staple.
Right. And in this way, that's what Pacino is telling him that they're doing to him.
Absolutely.
Yet you're putting him in the situation where he's unrecognizable as Rick Dalton.
Yeah.
So you're not really giving your guy as good of a rub because he's unrecognizable, and so the audience won't pick up on exactly who he's getting over on.
I didn't catch that.
So...
Yeah, that's you know...
But that whole sequence is, again, why I think this is Oscar-worthy, because it is about the industry and about how the director was talking to him and the choices the director was making and, you know, give me sexy Hamlet and...
Yeah.
Hold it.
I wonder if some of that was tongue-in-cheek, because I could just hear Tarantino yelling that on the set, something stupid like, give me sexy Hamlet. Everybody loves sexy Hamlet. Yeah.
So that was the thing you loved. My thing that I loved was I love Margot Robbie. She's not in this film nearly enough for me and for my taste, but the whimsy and just the embodiment of that actress and who she was and the personality that she had. And just, if you read anything about her, she was a bright light that just lit up any room that she walked into. The epitome of a woman in her early 20s in the 1960s. A woman who literally would have come of age in the 60s. She would have started the 60s as a young girl, and by the end would have been a woman. And, you know, just the accent, the facial expressions, the personality that she exudes. I loved Robbie's performance in this, and she's not in it nearly enough. And that was the thing that I loved the most about this film.
They did a great job, or she did in particular, of bringing that sweetness of Sharon Tate that everybody talks about right to the front.
Well, there's...
You love her the whole time.
Yeah. There's two scenes right there where you can immediately call it to four. One is the scene at the mansion that you talked about, where she just walks in dancing. She literally just walks in. She hugs Steve McQueen, and then they start walking in, and she takes the hand of another woman, and they just start dancing through the house all the way, and don't stop till they get to the dance floor.
It was Mama Cass and Michelle Phillips that she met there.
Right.
And the Mamas and the Papas.
Yeah, and then the other scene would be the theater scene where she goes to see her own movie.
Agreed. Yeah. She's so sweet about, hey, I'm in the movie.
Yeah, that's me.
Will y'all let me in if I'm in the movie? Can I just go watch it?
Right.
And then watching her, sorry to talk over you.
No, it's fine.
Watching her in the theater, watching herself on screen, and it was real Sharon Tate on screen. You saw that?
Yeah.
And watching everybody in the theater just love her, and she's starting to feel like, she's becoming an actress, I guess, and oh my God, people love me.
So she's losing that, you know, the girl from the Valley of the Dolls, and just becoming her own, her own brand, so to speak.
Yeah.
Which,
and you're starting to think she could really be big time, her life isn't about to be cut short.
Right. Which is a interesting place to be, considering that she's technically married to one of the rising star directors of the time, who was going to go on to have a Hall of Fame career of his own.
Huge. And she's in a Dean Martin movie, which we all know was enormous. I mean, you don't just stumble into a Dean Martin movie. So she's coming up.
Mm-hmm. And so those are the two scenes that just exude that for us and for me.
Yeah. I liked the scene, even just the sidebar scenes, her just meandering about having her day, packing a suitcase, looking out the window, listening to music. Because I was waiting for clues about Charles Manson. I was just waiting for something to go down. Because I know I'm watching this sweet young girl oblivious to the fact that she's about to be murdered.
Mm-hmm. And the other part of that too, and I don't think that many people catch it in the beginning, is that the first two acts of the movie, the acts structured, you know, we're so used to Tarantino movies where Tarantino is putting up chapters.
Yeah.
And he didn't do that this time. He used a traditional fade to black for his three act structure. So act one ends on the fade to black, and then act two ends on the fade to black. And then you get Ego of the Living Planet.
Kurt Russell's over.
You get Kurt Russell's voiceover.
Yeah.
And
The narrator, Kurt Russell.
And that's where you start act three. But the movie starts in February of 69. It mm-hmm. literally covers like 2 days in February of 69. And then that third act jumps to August 8th. August 8th, 1969. So
that was the jump where Rick's in Italy, and
right?
All that. Yeah,
that covers that those 6 months in Italy and all that. And so, you know, that's when we get the reveal that she's pregnant. That's where she has her friend over, and they have brunch, and they shows her the nursery, which of course would be so prominent. You know, all of that kind of stuff. So the clues would have more been in that section of the film than it would have been in the previous section in February.
But I mean, the timing would have been right. I just, again, people were complaining that the movie was dragging at the beginning, but knowing what was about to happen to her, I was glued to the scenes when I saw her, because I just thought something was going to click, and I'd be like, all right, now I see what's coming.
The hitchhiker scene is a great example of that, because the hitchhiker scene, you assume that might be one of the Manson girls that she picks up.
Well, it was, wasn't it?
I don't think it was.
She was on the ranch.
Was she?
Yeah.
Because
wait, the one that Sharon
picks up.
Okay. Yeah, I think she's just a generic
right.
baby.
And you know, again, you just... But in your mind, you're thinking this could be...
Here's how they pick her.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the fact that... that I know that Sharon Tate was a Hollywood sweetheart that everyone loved, and she was heavily pregnant when she was murdered and mutilated.
Yeah.
You know? It was... Morbid curiosity. I'm watching her, waiting to see where she made her fatal mistake. Because I just couldn't believe that. Again, I haven't researched Charles Manson and that gang, but I couldn't believe that they just randomly walked up to a house that. I mean, they obviously chose it, but I was trying to understand where.
Put the pieces together.
We never got any.
Yeah. So what was the thing that you were that you liked?
I really liked the misdirection at the ranch when Brad Pitt
goes to get Bruce Dern.
Yeah, Cliff.
Yeah.
picks up the hitchhiker Pussycat,
who's also great, by the way.
Yeah, she was awesome. And then they have their little. You know, there was a build-up. He saw her crossing the street a couple of times, and they sort of winked at each other or whatever, and noticed each other at a minimum. And then she's trying to hitch a ride with him, and he's going the different direction, just blows her off, but waves at her. And then he finally gets to pick her up, and she's so excited. And she wants him to take her to a place that he knows. And so he's on the way there, and of course she propositions him, and he turns her down, saying she's too young and all that.
Which ties back into the boat thing. Because if you notice,
I'm glad you saw.
Well, if you notice, he says there's a line. I've gone to jail. You know, I I forget what the exact text of the line is, but it's something to the extent of, I ain't going to jail, or I've been to jail, I ain't going back. If I go back, it ain't going to be because of pussy.
Yeah.
Or Putang, I think is how he says it. Yeah.
I thought there were a couple of subtle jabs at Roman Polanski in that movie where, back to the Playboy Mansion for a second, and Sharon Tate's dancing around, and Steve McQueen starts doing some exposition to, I can't remember who he was talking to, I think Michelle Phillips.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, that girl was married to that guy, then went on to a movie.
Was dating that guy.
Yeah.
And then went off to make a movie in London with Roman, and then dumped Jay, married Roman, and then Roman and her flew back to L.A. and got married and bought a house in the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah.
And now those three are inseparable.
Yeah. And those three guys are inseparable. And then Michelle Phillips, what does she say? Well, we know she has a type. Handsome and baby-faced. You know, yeah. Handsome and really young.
Look like a 12-year-old. Look like a
baby. Yeah. Roman Polanski. And then, what's the shot at? Pussycat and Cliff.
And then Cliff. Do you have any idea? Do you have any ID on you that to prove that you're over?
That was funny. And she was just so taken aback and said, nobody has ever asked me that.
And no one's ever turned her down either.
No. Nope. Oh, shit. I can see why.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That in
long story. I'm going to try to wind this up for you.
That in the boat also.
Yeah. That's what I was missing. I guess that was a jab at Robert Wagner, you know?
Yeah.
We'll never know. But obviously, somebody was missing on that boat. And I was looking up at lunch. Who else was on that boat with Robert Wagner? And do you know who was on that boat?
Who was on that boat?
Christopher Walken.
Oh, imagine that.
It was Natalie Wood, Bob Wagner, and Christopher Walken. I love that guy. Now I feel like I shouldn't love him as much. I'm pretty sure no one can prove it.
No.
I think everyone has a hunch that Natalie Wood didn't just...
A little bit smaller than OJ.
Yeah. So I think that was a dig at him as much as those young...
But it's also meant
to... Youngster references were to Roman.
But it's also to kind of set up the fact that Cliff can take care of himself physically. Like, it's part of the reason why you had the Bruce Lee fight, right? This guy went toe-to-toe with Bruce Lee. He is not to be effed with. And so when you get to the ranch and you're doing that whole build-up thing, it's like, how is he going to get himself out of this? Because if this goes the way we all think it's going to go, there's like 30 of them and one of him.
That ties in a little bit to what I was thinking about. I saw the Bruce Lee deal as a daydream. That wasn't a daydream. I thought Cliff was daydreaming about that whole thing, because it cuts off so quickly, and Cliff's like, oh yeah, that's probably, I probably would have thrown him into Kurt Russell's angry wife's car and gotten thrown off the set first thing. That's why I shouldn't be out here working.
No, the whole deal was, remember the list of projects that Cliff runs down, that Rick runs down when he meets with Pacino? Mm-hmm. Two of them are Land of the Giants and Green Hornet.
Yeah, okay.
And so what he's doing is, they're the shot when they're in the car and they pull up to the set and he drops them off. And this is right before he says, "It's Rick, you know, you're Rick effing Dalton, like, you know, go kill it today," mm-hmm. which is just, you know, the nice best friend thing to say. He asks him if he's talked to the grip man to know whether or not he's going to be working. And he's like, well, the grip man is the best friend of the guy from Green Hornet. So it just really isn't worth me even trying. And so then you get that backstory when he goes up on the roof and he's thinking back to it. This is why the guy who's the grip on Green Hornet wouldn't hire him again. Yeah. Or would tell all of his friends not to hire him. Because of this incident with Bruce that happened on the Green Hornet set.
That's what it was.
Yes.
I missed that. I love that scene, though, when Bruce is talking all that trash about being able to beat... Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali.
It's still one of my favorite lines, and it was in the trailer, but it's still one of my favorite lines. And when he goes, "My hands are registered as lethal weapons."
Yeah, yeah.
And then, "If I hit you and you die, if we get in a fight and I punch you and you accidentally die, I could go to jail." And And Cliff Booth is like, well, if anybody gets in a fight and accidentally kills anybody, they all go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
Man, yeah. You know, he was just so slick. Yeah. There was nothing that could throw old Cliff off course. There's nothing you could throw at him that he wouldn't duck under and have something smart out to say about it.
And it's interesting, the actor who played Bruce Lee in that came out and said that, yeah, if it had gone about 2 more minutes, that Bruce would have totally knocked Cliff to the ground if it wouldn't have been stopped.
Yeah, according to what everybody says, Bruce is about one of the baddest dudes that's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And that would include Chuck Norris, for all you Chuck Norris fans. Even Chuck says that Bruce was almost untouchable.
Yeah.
But back to the...
Yeah, as for what I liked, the thing that I liked the most about this movie was the setting, and the way the setting plays almost like a character in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the shot designs, one of the ones that I would say is most impressive to me is the shot of the crane shot going over Rick's house, observing Rick in the pool, and then flying over to Roman's house. Mm-hmm. Like I said earlier, the scene of all the neon lights flashing on and just the transition there, the shot of the move of the freeway and then turning off the electric, the neon windmill and going to the drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
And again, sky camming over the drive-in. The way that the city plays when he's driving around, you know, picking up the hippie, when he's passing by Pussycat. The authenticity of the radio commercials that are playing on the radio in between the songs. The song choices. Soundtrack's awesome.
Loved all that.
Those are all things that I really liked about this film. But I think that the thing I liked the most would be this ending.
Yeah.
I've tweeted out to a number of people who've talked about this film, and I've said that, you know, for me, I want to live in the alternate reality that he creates here because by taking the route that they did and letting her live, which, by the way, they didn't show like her, like Margot frontally meeting Leo, because that would have been the first time those two have been on screen together since Wolf.
Oh, yeah.
Since Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah.
But having her live creates an entire alternate reality. First of all, she gives birth to that child who goes on to have whatever kind of life and career that child is supposed to have.
Okay.
If she stays married to Roman, there's a distinct possibility Roman doesn't get himself in as much trouble as he did.
Yeah.
And then he may have had a longer career, yeah, which...
What could we have had?
Which would have produced many, many more movies. Like you said, who knows what kind of film. Rick Dalton...
Yeah.
...gets what he talked about in the beginning of the movie to Cliff, where he's like, I'm one pool party away from being the next Roman
that
adventure.
That was satisfying.
And so that probably happens because now they've hung out and he's been over to his house and he's known as the neighbor who... You know, took care of those crazy hippies that came charging into the neighborhood.
Take care of them?
And then, so like, you create this whole alternate reality where she continues to have a child and make movies and be, you know, the Raquel Welch of the 70s, basically. And he continues to make movies, and Dalton continues to make, you know, movies at a higher rate, which means he can continue to pay Cliff, so he doesn't have to sell the house.
Yeah.
So, you know...
It was a feel-good. Murdering 3 hippies who try to murder you...
Right.
...is the feel-good ending. Hard to believe. The flamethrower felt really good.
Again, I just love the fact that that's a callback.
Yeah.
And it's... I love the fact that he was like, I trained on this weapon for a week.
And they show him being such a bitch about it.
Yeah. Can we do something about that heat? It's a flamethrower, Rick. Can't really do anything about the heat.
Oh, man, I love that.
But that you
did not expect the flamethrower to come out of the pool house.
No, but the other thing is, like, again, that's something that's happened in the first 15 minutes of a 2-hour and 40-minute movie. So by the time you get there,
mm-hmm.
you've already forgotten that was a thing that Rick Dalton fried a bunch of sauerkrauts.
That's right. I forgot about that scene completely. And all his terrible one-liners during that scene.
Yeah. So,
They did make his old shows feel kind of like he was a hack, didn't they?
Yes. Well, the movies especially. I mean, that's why Rick himself admits that. That's why Rick turns to him and says, you know, I hope the double feature wasn't too much of a trouble for you and the missus.
Because he was assuming they were watching bad movies, right?
Well, because they were assuming that the only movies he's ever done had been bad.
Yeah.
And he tells the only time he's ever come close to stardom in his feature career was, you know, a screen test for, what's the McQueen movie?
I don't know the name of that movie.
Yeah.
And I should.
It was a McQueen movie, a McQueen war movie.
Yep.
That he was auditioning for and he had a screen test for and didn't get, obviously.
That's right. That came out later that he didn't get it.
Yeah. They didn't get. That was the closest thing to actual, like, stardom. And that's the closest to, like, actual, like, Leo that he looks like in that film. In the film. So...
Yeah. Well, they really had me leaning on that, that he was just a hack actor. You know, that they had, like you said, he was frying the sauerkraut, cooking whatever it was, and he was doing those awful
Anybody one-liners. Order some fried sauerkraut?
And then all his terrible one-liners during his old westerns.
Yeah.
And then the scene in the makeup trailer when they basically emasculate him.
Right. They cut his balls off.
Then they roll him out and he flubs the scene. Then he meets the girl, the child actor, who's just on another level compared to him. He starts to realize, oh, man. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was so satisfying to me when he killed that last scene. And, of course, it was awesome. Watching DiCaprio do that was...
Right, but that also sets the stage for him to accept Pacino's offer. Because remember, he was crying, thinking that, you know, that doing Italian westerns was beneath him.
Would kill his career.
Right.
Whatever career he might be able to pull.
Right, and then he left and went and ultimately did that for 6 months. The best part about that for me was the line about how, you know, Rick had some money in his pocket, but he would have had more money in his pocket had, you know, had he not bought his fancy Italian apartment.
Slipped back into his highfalutin Hollywood ways.
Huh? Right.
He just couldn't quite get rid of that.
But he found himself a wife.
Yeah, well, I was saying how they had me leaning, thinking that Leo was going to fail on that TV Western. Where he was hired just to be the heavy and make their star look better. And of course, Tarantino gave me exactly what I wanted, which is DiCaprio kills that scene, that next scene. And then they had me really leaning at that ranch with Cliff. When all 30 of those hippies are out there trying not to let him in that house. And you just assume they've killed that old man.
Which was supposed to be the Burt Reynolds role.
I don't know. What do you mean?
Burt Reynolds was cast in at the table read for this movie. He was going to be in this movie, and the role he was going to play...
I didn't know that.
The role he was going to play was the role of the owner of the ranch.
No kidding.
And so, ultimately, Bruce Dern's like 500 years old, so they got Bruce Dern. Last time we saw him in a Tarantino movie was in Once Upon a Time Hateful Eight, where he was playing the racist old Civil War general.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
But, so he was a favorite of Tarantino's. He'd worked with him before. And so when Burt died, they just slid him in there.
But he was good.
That was supposed to be Burt's role.
I thought there was going to be nobody in that room. I thought Brad Pitt was going to go in there and come out and the Manson family was going to get him.
Right.
You know, right there at the ranch, 30 people.
Yeah.
You know, and nope, there he is laying in the back. The hippies are screwing him. He's happy as can be. He watches his FBI shows every Sunday night, whatever it was.
Yeah,
man, they got me on that one.
And it's all because you had base knowledge of Manson family murders.
Yeah,
and who these hippies are and what they're doing.
Man,
and
then he got me so many times with that, with switching up the story on me. That's probably part of the reason I love the movie so much.
And then that also leads to you, the hippie getting his ass kicked and a little bit of blood before the major blood, where he's like, change my tire.
I misread that scene. I thought, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I thought that the whole Bruce Lee scene was just a daydream and didn't happen. And I wasn't certain at that point that Cliff was a badass. I had an assumption that he was. I figured he could beat up a hippie.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, he whooped that dude's ass pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And then drove off just in time for Tex to miss him. So it's so he wouldn't really recognize Tex when Tex shows up later at the house, despite him being on an acid-laced cigarette.
Right.
Which that scene was... I'm sure we'll talk about that scene in a minute.
So what were the things you'd change?
Your answers seem so much better than mine. Mine are mostly scenes and actors, but here it goes anyway. I wanted more of the Tims. I am a big Timothy Olyphant fan. I love Justified and pretty much most of his movies. I didn't really like that Santa Clarita Diet where Drew Barrymore was a zombie on Netflix or whatever, but I love him in most of his stuff. And I know he's not a star in this movie, but I just wanted to see a little bit of more of him and Leo, maybe a little bit more of Tim being the big shot. When he meets Rick, when Timothy Olyphant's character meets Leo's character, he introduces himself as, hey, you know, this is so-and-so, this is my movie, welcome to the set. And you can just see Leo bristling, he's like, okay, asshole, you know. I wanted a little bit more of Timothy Olyphant big league in Leo DiCaprio, because you know he couldn't do that in real life.
Right.
But I wanted a little bit more of that. He gave you a little bit when he was doing his scene and Leo was messing up his lines and you could just see, you know, the big dog actor Tim was itching.
Yeah.
But I like Tim Roth. And the only fun movies I ever get to see him in anymore are my Tarantino flicks. And we both caught this somehow at the same time during the credits. They have Tim Roth as a cut character. I would have loved to have him in the movie. You have any idea what that was?
I don't.
We'll have to get the DVD.
The only other scene that I know was cut, there was a gentleman who was supposed to play Burt Reynolds in the film, and they cut him. They cut the character.
I mean, I know the movie was long enough already, and it's the buddy movie. It's not about those guys, but I could have used a little bit more.
I'm putting more Shannon stuff. Like, we need as much...
You mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah, we need as much of with her as we do with Rick and Cliff. More interaction with her and Jay and Roman. And, like, what is this thing? Like, are we living in a, like, Mormon commune here? Like, how is this working with the three of you? I know it's the late 60s, early 70s, but, like, is this a wife-sharing deal? Like, what's going on here? Was Roman the father of the child, or was Jay the father of the child? Like, was there there any kind of drama there?
I think because you like that alternate universe that they've created, and you want to know more about that future story.
Well, because the McQueen's right at the end there. He's like, Jay's just waiting for Roman to screw up.
Mm-hmm. So he can get back with Sharon.
Right. Because he loves her. And, you know, that kind of a thing, I wish we could have spent more time in the bookstore. The little prop bookstore that she goes into to get the book before she goes to the theater. I love the fact that all the marquees are, you know, again, time period accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And Margot has great chops, and she is actually a good actress. This isn't just a situation where we've got Elizabeth Hurley, from the late 90s, early 2000s, where it's just
a pretty face,
the hot girl with the nice figure that can't really do much. I mean, Robbie has done multiple roles now that show that she has range and she has chops.
Yeah.
So I would have loved to have seen her have some scenes with Roman, because we don't get a lot of her and Roman together, except for the party scene. We don't see their interaction the way we see her and Jay's interaction in that scene where Charles comes up and Manson comes up and is walking around.
Yeah, I guess...
That, and also, I would have extended out the 10-minute set piece of violence out to 15 or 20, because I feel like Tarantino could have come up with some more inventive ways of using the house to create more bloodshed, besides just banging somebody's head into the phone repeatedly.
Yeah, I know Pete is upset about the way they portrayed the dog, but I loved that.
Oh, yeah.
The dog was
the whistle. Yeah, the whistle.
I guess I was okay with the small amount of Sharon Tate, because she did such a good job bringing that sweetness to the role, and you fell in love with her right away. And I just assumed I was getting more later.
Yeah.
You know, I just assumed I was going to see the bad stuff at the end with Charles Manson. And so when the end happened, I was so happy that Tarantino flipped the script on us and killed the hippies.
Yeah. The only thing
I didn't notice, I didn't.
You killed the Manson family members, and Cliff has already been to the ranch, so Cliff has the knowledge of the ranch and where they are, and recognizes where those hippies came from. So when he comes down off of his acid trip, he's able to tell the police about the ranch and about the hippies and the things that they're doing to the owner, and that causes the cops to go out to the ranch, and then they would have access to arresting Manson before any of the other crazy stuff happens.
Then you got to wonder, does Charles Manson go to prison at all for it? Because did he murder anybody?
Or,
no.
Or does he become...
Is he out and does he have a future?
Yeah.
Does he get even more evil?
Probably continues to try and make music and continues to get turned down and continues to get pissed off at the world and eventually probably still starts his own cult, but...
I would have loved to have seen... Maybe I should put that as my... What would I like to change? Maybe a little bit more of Charles Manson. We got just that little taste of him walking up to the house.
We don't get anything with him and the family.
No.
We don't get anything with him and the family. No, like, long Tarantino monologues of Manson speaking dialogue. But...
That would have... He could have done such good stuff with that. I mean, we're talking about a guy who's... who's obviously crazy... but charismatic, and people liked him. I mean, he had a cult following, but people liked him before. I mean, he hung out with the Beatles, and he wrote songs with the Beach Boys, and he was, you know, some people say a good writer, a good talented musician.
Helter Skelter, yeah.
Yeah, and Tarantino could have done a lot with that. I mean, I'm okay not having a Charles Manson movie, don't get me wrong, but that would have been
interesting. And that was the concern when they announced the movie, was that, you know, glorifying Manson. But the thing is there, he had Tate's niece or something. He had members of the Tate family on the producer credits. So they were intimately involved on the development of her character and how she looked. And ain't no one on the planet who could probably have played her and looked that way, the way that Robbie does.
She did such... I read somewhere, I might get this a little bit wrong, but I think it was Sharon Tate's sister came on set and cried and loved Margaret and said, it almost felt like my sister was there. I didn't feel like in that interview she gave, and it was in print,
right?
But I didn't feel like she was just blowing smoke and saying things for just being overdramatic. She said that they really nailed Sharon in the movie. And that feels good.
That does feel good. So...
feel good, Tarantino.
Feel good, Tarantino. Sweet Tarantino.
I loved it. I mean, I can't say that I'm probably a broken record with that, but it's... I had such a good time at that movie. It disappointed me hearing that people thought it was boring. I couldn't believe it.
So, let's move to what you want next from this gentleman, because he's just got a self-imposed 10 film retirement age. He's now married. He wants to have a life outside of film. Doesn't feel like being a married film producer, film director, is the best way to go when you want kids.
Well, I'm sure he pours himself into his work. And
right.
Is a
70-hour work week.
Complete loss
detail.
To family.
Yeah.
To Chad's dismay, I know he does not like space war films.
Yeah.
Or shootouts in space or whatever it is that he dislikes. I would love to see what you had told me months ago that was rumored, that he wanted to take a shot at a Star Trek. Would love that. How crazy would that be?
An R-rated Star Trek movie. Him and JJ have talked about. It's been written that he's going to take another pass on the script, and he hasn't decided whether or not he would actually.
I'm just laughing to myself about. Imagine if they plugged in a Captain Kirk type and let him monologue in a Tarantino style.
Oh no!
R-rated flick.
He's already said he wants the Chris Pine crew.
He's going to stay. Okay.
He wants the Chris Pine crew.
And so that would be JJ's. Okay.
Yeah. He wants the Chris Pine crew.
Well, Chris Pine could do it.
Yeah, the Chris Pine crew with an R-rated Tarantino movie with...
As long as they modify the characters enough to... I wouldn't mind having the complete change to the Tarantino style.
I don't know that Trekkies would accept an R-rated, ultra-violent Star Trek movie.
That's part of the fun.
I don't, even if he decided to do that, it wouldn't be an original. I don't think he would count it towards 10. I don't think he would go out on an original.
Good news for me. I'm ready for 10
and,
more.
And whatever his next original is, I mean, that could be almost anything. I mean, he spent 8 years writing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He spent...
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He was working on that all the way back when they was doing Django.
Well, I'll throw out there... I can't remember if it was you that set me off on this Google foo to Kill Bill 3.
It gets brought up on every press tour. It's been brought up on every press tour that he's done for the last three movies. The only change to this week was that he said that him and Uma had talked, and they needed to talk because they had the issues with after Harvey and the talks about the car crashes on Kill Bill and the safety on set safety and the things that were being allowed to go on. So they needed to talk. Those two did. But whether or not you could actually do a Kill Bill 3 or would want to do a Kill Bill 3, he's on record as saying it's the only one of his films that feels like there's a natural sequel to. Because he considers Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2 to be the whole bloody affair, which is those two films intercut together to make one long movie.
Oh, he considers them one flick.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Does it feel natural to have more... Beatrix? I mean, like, what, he says that's the natural sequel. I don't know. It wouldn't be. But he's talking about Uma. It's her daughter. Is that the idea? Is that
just could sort of be. I mean, Maya Hawke is in this movie. As the hippie that runs away.
I don't want to go too off the rails on Weinstein and all that, but I didn't know that he and Uma had some static about Harvey. I know they did about how she got in that car
wreck
and
was
on set safety. Her pleas of safety were ignored on set. I didn't know that. Honestly, I got tired of all the Harvey news, and I stopped after a while. But did Tarantino come out and try to defend him or something? Or
Tarantino's stance on that was simply, I don't believe that the man's name should be scrubbed from everything.
Okay.
So, like, because the specific question he gets asked is, like, this guy financed pretty much through Miramax or Weinstein Films, pretty much financed your entire career.
Yeah.
All his name's all over all of your movies. And he's like, well, he paid for them. His name's going to stay on them. Like, he paid for them.
It's like, funny how he doesn't want that revisionist history, so to speak. But then he changes up Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and we get the different take on Manson Murders. I definitely don't want to go down the rabbit hole on Weinstein.
And Selma Hayek had raised concerns on the Frida film. I mean, tons of people had over the years. So, but that'll about do it for this week's podcast. We'd like to thank Steven for showing up and talking about Tarantino for an hour.
I had fun, man. Appreciate it.
We hope that everybody has a safe and wonderful week, and we'll see you again next time.